Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Democratic-controlled House is getting ready to pass the $1.9 trillion COVID relief plan. President Biden is then expected to sign it. The bill will send a direct $1,400 payment to millions of people, expand the child tax credit, and extend weekly unemployment by $300. Now, we know that this bill is desperately needed. 1 in 7 children in the United States live in poverty, according to the Center for American Progress. The U.S. has one of the worst child poverty rates among any major country on earth. 17 million children struggle with hunger in the United States, 6 million more than before the pandemic. This is according to a new report from Save the Children. It found that across the country, the poorest families are upwards of 15 times as likely as the wealthiest to be hungry. Here in California, estimates suggest half of poor families do not have enough to eat. Well, when this relief bill, it'll help tens of millions of families, but many will still struggle to make ends meet because they are working in low-wage jobs or they're struggling to find a job. Today's guest, economics commentator Grace Blakely, says we need to understand the likely impact this crisis will have on the economy and prepare accordingly. In her new book, The Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism, she asks, if the state could afford to spend billions bailing out the country's wealthy bankers, then why shouldn't it provide free higher education, housing, and healthcare when this crisis ends? Grace Blakely is a staff writer at Tribune Magazine and host of their weekly podcast, A World to Win. She was a research fellow at the Institute for Public Policy Research Center for Economic Justice. She's also the author of Stolen, How to Save the World from Financialization. Her latest book, again, is called The Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism. Hi, Grace. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I'm really glad that we got you on the show because I've been wanting to hear a European perspective for a while now. Given that you are from the UK, I first want to ask you overall what you think of the United States' response to the pandemic. What has this been looking like to you in the UK?
Well, I mean, it's like, I think it's a case of those in glass houses not being able to throw stones. I think both the US and the UK have, up to this point, handled the crisis pretty terribly. Obviously, the vaccine rollout in both countries is going pretty well. But again, that kind of comes down to this situation that we have that some campaigners have described as vaccine apartheid, where basically the wealthiest states in the world have been able to get privileged access to the vaccines and then use, you know, admittedly fairly, you know, good infrastructure in many cases to roll out the vaccine program. But obviously up to this point, you know, the response from both the US and the UK was slow. There were reopenings in the UK when perhaps that wasn't particularly well advised, particularly thinking of schools in the UK opening and that leading to quite a significant increase in cases. In the US, obviously, the situation is different because it varies state by state and the national lockdown really hasn't been, you know, as kind of effective. And obviously, there are all these variations in terms of people's likelihood to obey the rules based on kind of political leanings, which I think is less of a problem perhaps in the UK, although obviously people have you know, either been confused about the rules or perhaps not stuck to them for other reasons. So the general context in which this vaccine rollout was taking place was not particularly propitious. And I think that really comes down to, you know, all of these issues, the slowness of the response, the desire to open up too quickly, perhaps out of concerns about the state of the economy, and often kind of not taking into account the concerns of labor organizations, particularly teachers unions and other advocates for working people who were saying, you know, we can't open up because this is going to increase cases. All of these really come down to the kind of approach that these governments have taken, particularly the Trump government, and obviously under Boris Johnson in the UK, to basically thinking that, you know, the state shouldn't do too much in any one situation. And it would be kind of better to let, you know, in inverted commas, the market take care of things. Although, as you mentioned in that quote that came from my book, these governments are kind of all too happy to intervene in the market when it comes down to, you know, corporate welfare or military spending, or providing kind of huge amounts of money to private organizations to provide healthcare or test and trace services, or all these other things. So, you know, and again, we can come back to this question. You mentioned it very eloquently in the introduction to this piece. What we've really seen is a K-shaped recovery, in the sense that inequality is rising quite substantially. And a lot of that comes down to actually kind of upward redistribution that these states have undertaken over the course of the pandemic. So some people are doing a lot better than others.
Exactly. I mean, that is really an understatement here in the United States. When you look at what's going on with billionaires, the country's 664 billionaires saw their wealth shoot past $4 trillion in February, which is up 44% since the pandemic began last year.
Yeah. And I think, again, it's very important to come back to the central point here, which is that a big factor in the dramatic increase in wealth inequality in both the US and the UK has been central bank money creation and asset purchasing programs. So the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England have both kind of taken fairly unprecedented measures in terms of money creation and using that new money to purchase assets of a very wide variety in the US. The government has, well, the central bank, sorry, has basically stepped in to backstop loads of different markets, everything from, you know, municipal bonds to high yield corporate bonds to obviously government bonds, which they were doing anyway. And what this, you know, has done, what this quantitative easing program has done, is really create a huge amount of inflation, but a particular kind of inflation, which is asset price inflation. So if you have a lot of wealth in the US or to a lesser extent, there's still a significant extent in the UK. If you have a lot of wealth, then you've probably seen that increase over the course of the pandemic, and actually over the course of the last decade, ever since these programs were introduced in the wake of the financial crisis. Governments have really stepped in to say, well, central banks again, but, you know, we don't know the kind of the links between policymakers in different parts of the state. There's likely to be some, you know, lineup there. But central banks have really stepped up to backstop the wealth of those at the very top and many middle class folks as well. And, you know, the best illustration of this was obviously the recent GameStop saga, which I think really speaks to this fact that lots of Americans have kind of realized the stock market is at the moment pretty much a one way bet, because central banks are stepping in to backstop these asset prices. And indeed, you know, the GameStop saga did show that actually the game is rigged. For a lot of people, it really is a question of being able to make a one-way bet and increase your wealth, often, you know, at the expense of other public programs. And, you know, the massive increase in the wealth of people like Jeff Bezos, which is a combination of those central bank programs and also the kind of hyper exploitation of Amazon workers throughout the country, is a really, really good example of that.
And we'll talk about that a little later in the show. But given that you spend so much time writing about economic interventions in your piece, for people who maybe don't know how all of this works, can you be specific? When you say central bankers, what do you mean by that? Because you write that central bankers and politicians have staged unprecedented economic interventions, not to help the most vulnerable through this crisis, but to save capitalism from itself. So tell us more about these central bankers.
Yeah, I mean, this is a topic I could conceivably talk about for quite some time, but I'll try and keep it brief. Around the time of kind of the 1980s and 90s, it became very in vogue in economic circles to suggest that central banks, which are in charge of setting things like interest rates, have often a remit over financial stability and various other responsibilities over the kind of monetary and financial system. The idea was at that time that central banks should be made independent so that they wouldn't be subject to interference from politicians. And basically the reasoning here allegedly was that politicians would have an incentive to cut interest rates and make borrowing very cheap around elections and then increase them again later down the line, and that would have a negative impact on the economic cycle. So there was this big pressure to have central bank independence and basically kind of cordon off central banks from the rest of the state. So in the US, you have the Federal Reserve, which is kind of an independent institution that has a mandate that's set by the government But, you know, it has kind of free rein to determine how it will implement that mandate. And that's very similar to how most central banks around the world work. The ECB is slightly different because obviously it's in a very different context. But effectively, this idea of central bank independence makes the central bank a kind of separate institution from the state. The issue is, of course, that, you know, the surface level reasons for this move were not perhaps completely illustrative of the interests that move served. Because what you really started to see after central banks became independent was that they were perhaps under less pressure from politicians, though not an insignificant amount of pressure from politicians still, but they became a lot more under the influence of particularly kind of financial interests. And you'll often see, you know, central banks are located in or around financial districts, and senior central bankers will have lots of meetings with people in the financial system. They will say out of necessity, but that also means that you get this kind of, you know, level of both a kind of revolving door and also a level of kind of policy convergence and convergence of interest between these different groups. So what we then started to see was central banks making a lot of moves that would in one way or another benefit certain generally kind of wealthier financial interests over other areas of the economy. This was very clear in the UK, for example. We have evidence of central bankers saying, well, unemployment in the north of the country, which has generally produced less output, had higher unemployment, is a small price to pay for kind of a boom in London and in the financial center of the country. And so interest rates were set, and interest rates obviously affect the cost of borrowing and therefore tend to mean, especially in an economy that's so dependent on debt as the UK and the US are, that lower interest rates are often associated with, you know, economic booms and higher levels of borrowing and often also economic growth as well. So central banks, decisions around interest rates were clearly influenced by those financial interests. But this really came to a new level after the financial crisis. And the reason for that is this thing called quantitative easing. Now, you know, I don't want to get too bogged down in the details of, you know, how monetary policy works and what this thing called quantitative easing is. But the simplest way to explain it is basically that central banks have the power to create money. They are the issuers of the currency of a particular state. And over the course of the last 10 years since the financial crisis, they used this power basically to try and get the economy going again. And the reason that they had to do this was because they couldn't cut interest rates any lower. They were already at basically the lowest levels they could possibly go, and the economy still wasn't really, you know, getting started again. So they decided, right, what we're going to do, we're going to create loads of new money and we're going to use it to purchase assets from the private sector. And initially this was mainly government bonds, so government debt, but eventually it became, you know, all sorts of different assets, things like corporate debt as well, and, you know, municipal debt, as I mentioned in this crisis. And basically what that did was it exchanged, you know, you're a private financial institution, you're holding a lot of government bonds one day, and then the next day, the central bank has bought those bonds off you, and you have loads of cash. So those bonds are now with the central bank, you have loads of cash. What are you going to do with that cash? Well, you need to invest it to deliver a return for your clients. So you're going to use that to buy up, you know, some government bonds, but also other assets as well. And what that really did was obviously shift the balance between supply and demand for lots of different assets, particularly stocks and shares, but also other things like corporate debt and housing. And because there was more money chasing the same amount of stuff, broadly speaking, the prices of things like equities, like shares, went through the roof. And this has been a really significant factor in explaining the rise in wealth inequality over the last 10 years. And I think it again comes back to this question of, you know, the role of central banks in our economy and in the state, because they were made independent basically so they could become technocratic overseers of the economy, basically. But no one really questioned at the time whose interests they would prioritize when making these decisions. And now we have the situation where, you know, not only are central banks buying up all these assets, pushing up asset prices, increasing wealth inequality, often they're also buying assets that are actually, you know, contributing to climate breakdown. This could be, for example, the debt of banks or corporations that are, you know, not particularly green. So there's a lot of pressure on central banks at the moment to basically kind of, you know, firstly admit what they're doing, and secondly to you know, come up with more equitable solutions to try and get the economy working again. To be fair on central bankers, a lot of the problem that they're facing is that they have this target. They've got to try and, you know, get inflation up to certain levels, to get consumer price inflation up to certain levels. So that means getting the economy started again, creating jobs, that sort of stuff. And the government up to now has not really been supporting that effort because governments often haven't been spending enough to make sure that that their economies are getting going again. But there is still this issue that, you know, central bankers are playing this big role in increasing wealth inequality. And what that means is that the state is basically transferring wealth from one part of the economy to another. And there's no accountability there because they're these independent institutions that aren't really responsive to politicians.
Well, if anyone has questions about central banks and how they work and how they contribute to inequality, I mean, the fact is this just does not get that much attention when we're talking about the economy. I mean, you need more than a 5-minute soundbite, obviously, to really talk about this. So if you have any questions for our guest today, Grace Blakely, her new book is called The Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Grace, I do wonder how you've been able to really explain all of this in a way that people can understand, because there's so much to unpack here.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, I think there's two issues here. One of them is that you're right. You know, we are talking about things that are relatively complicated and which aren't a central part of the curriculum, which, you know, a lot of people, unless they go out themselves and try and figure out how things work, perhaps won't really be exposed to. But I think there's another issue here, which is that a lot of the kind of terminology that's used to talk about the economy, I think is often deliberately made more complicated than it needs to be. And, you know, you can understand why this might be the case, certainly for, you know, the policymakers and, you know, financiers and executives who make up the upper echelons of our society. They'd have a direct interest in making sure that they sound like they're the experts and that the vast majority of people can't really question their authority. One of the best ways to do that is to develop quite a kind of arcane vocabulary that most people find it quite difficult to understand. And economics has achieved that, certainly, particularly over the past kind of 40 years, really, with the what's called the neoclassical revolution. So the move within economics towards highly kind of mathematical models of the way that the economy works that rest on a lot of quite complicated assumptions about, you know, human nature and firm behavior and all these different sorts of things, and away from more kind of intuitive models of the economy that you might have had, you know, for example, like Adam Smith is not a particularly difficult book person to read. But if you picked up your kind of modern economics textbook, a lot of people would be shocked at how you know, different the world that is described in those textbooks is from the world that they encounter in their daily lives. I think, though, the most important thing to mention here is that most of the time, and this is less true in more unequal societies because people's experiences of the world diverge to such a great extent, but most of the time, the things that you're experiencing when you go to work, when you go out and buy goods and services, you know, when you talk to your friends about your savings or whatever, most of those things will tell you something useful about how the economy is working for people like you. So I think, you know, there is something to be said for trusting your intuition about a lot of these things, whether that's the inequality that you observe, whether it's the power that you have at work, your wages, the rates that you're getting on your savings. These things are kind of telling you something about the way that the economy works. It's really just a question of kind of trying to connect that to a wider understanding, I suppose, of what drives those factors. And for me, you know, I come at this from a kind of critical perspective. So it's not just about saying, you know, well, if we cut taxes to X percent, then economic growth will go up to Y percent. The perspective I take is really about looking at the kind of the way in which how we structure society affects the way that the economy works. So how does, for example, the assault on the labor movement affect wages? How does the, you know, increasing ease with which money can flow around the world affect things like inequality? How does monopoly power affect climate breakdown and inequality? And these are much kind of broader questions that I think are much more intuitive and people can understand to a much greater extent. Although obviously, you know, it is still worth trying to understand slightly more complicated questions like central banking and the finance system. And there are quite a lot of resources online that people can find. And yeah, you know, if people want recommendations as to those, I'd be happy to provide them.
And it really is incredible when you think about where we are today, where people in many states are still in the United States making $7.25 an hour. The tipped wage is $2.13 an hour. And according to Brookings, and I just wish that this stat would get more attention, almost half of all people in the United States work in low-wage jobs. The median annual wage is $18,000, almost half of all workers.
Yeah, I mean, we have relatively high levels of inequality in the UK, but inequality in the US is truly staggering. And that's partly because it's a very big place. And the reason that I say that is because when you live in a small economy like the UK or a smaller kind of economy in Europe, or even a, you know, a part of the US, it's easy to look around you to look at how a lot of your kind of friends are in similar jobs as you, they're earning similar amounts as you. You know, maybe the kind of environment in which you're living, it gives you a fairly high standard of living. But actually, a lot of our lives and lifestyles are dependent upon the exploitation of people somewhere else. And, you know, over the last kind of 50-ish years, we've seen a lot of that exploitation be exported to other parts of the world. So, you know, how can most people afford an iPhone, for example? It's because, you know, the workers producing a lot of the equipment that goes into that are paid very, very low wages in economies like, you know, China and parts of Southeast Asia. But also, how can certain people afford to, you know, have high wage jobs that allow, that take them away from home all the time, or they pay cleaners, many of whom will be migrants and who will often be accepting a lower wage than they might do in a circumstance in which they had more power. You can say the same for a lot of kind of lower wage jobs that have increasingly become very prominent in even within rich economies. So like logistics, workers in, as I said, kind of Amazon warehouses, care work is very, very poorly remunerated in a lot of cases. Retail, all these kind of low paid service jobs are often very, very poorly paid. And a big part of explaining why that is that these jobs are, so either they're performed by women predominantly. A good friend of mine, David Graeber, who sadly died last year, had a very interesting explanation for this, which was to say, you know, we live in a very patriarchal culture and women are thought of as carers. So they shouldn't really have to be paid that much to care for other people. And a lot of those low wage jobs are in care work, and a lot of them performed by women and particularly migrant women. So that's one thing that it's very important to always bear in mind. Another thing is that a lot of those professions are harder to unionize than sectors that we may have seen dominate in the economy in the past. Retail workers, for example, are notoriously difficult to organize. They're spaced out across you know, a wide variety of stores. They are performing emotional labor of one kind or another. So if they want to keep their jobs, they have to be smiley, happy. They can't be causing trouble. You know, there isn't often a kind of area in which they can convene and discuss pay and conditions and all these sorts of things. So for both of these reasons, accompanied by just the massive increase in corporate power in the economy, which, you know, often means, for example, there are certain places in the UK where Amazon warehouses provide jobs for, you know, maybe up to like 40 to 50% of the workforce. If you leave that job, where else are you going to go? So that question of corporate power, the really just the imbalance of power that exists between the bosses and the people who own all the stuff and people who have to work for a living has just increased so dramatically in recent years. And that's really why in the US, the average worker is as badly off in purchasing power parity terms, which basically just means, you know, you could adjusting for the average cost of the basket of goods that you would need to buy to have the kind of average standard of living in different periods of time or in different parts of the world. So adjusting for purchasing power parity, the average US worker is as badly off as they were in 1979. And in the UK, the average worker before this crisis hit hadn't had a pay rise since the financial crisis. This, you know, is obviously increasing inequality. It's obviously leading to upward redistribution. It's not a coincidence that Amazon shareholders have done so well, while Amazon workers have perhaps done so badly. And it's the same case for, you know, a lot of retail workers, care workers, etc. US healthcare companies, for example, some of the biggest companies on the planet. And yet a lot of their kind of frontline workers aren't going to be paid particularly high wages. So really, what this comes down to is this question of power. And again, this is not something that is studied by most economists. They kind of take the world and, you know, the institutions that and the kind of social institutions that exist within it as given, and then kind of, you know, try to mathematically analyze how, you know, exchange might take place within that context. Whereas for those of us who take a more kind of critical perspective, we're actually saying, right, well, where is power in our societies and how is that affecting economic outcomes?
Well, we are going to take a quick break. Today, we are speaking with Grace Blakely, staff writer at the Tribune magazine, a left-wing magazine in the UK, and host of their weekly podcast, A World to Win. Grace is out with a new book, The Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism. After a break, we'll talk about how European countries responded to the pandemic versus the United States, especially when it comes to unemployment benefits and ensuring that people did not lose their health care. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call, which is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. A very good morning to you. I'm David LaTulipe. It's Wednesday, March 10th, Hump Day. Here to tell us more about that in more ways than one is our development director, John Carroll.
Hi, David. And yeah, if you're just joining us, we're in the midst of our special 3-day membership campaign, and there's just one more day to go. It's ending tomorrow, so you're almost out of time to help support the station that you love, and you can make your contribution by phone or online right now while you're thinking about it. So give us a call at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or call or join us online at klw.org. And, you know, we know you can get your news from anywhere. You can get your information from anywhere. But if you want to get a better understanding of how the news relates or what the context is to you with you and your own community, this is the place you come for that context. We go beyond the headlines, and it plays out in a lot of ways. For instance, the COVID information that we've provided during the pandemic, the election coverage that we just did this past November, and, you know, in today's Your Call show with Rose around these issues of income inequality and how that plays out in the economy. So those are the kinds of stories that we cover, and that's what we're asking you to support. Day after day, we bring this to you joyfully because we love the work that we do and we want to make sure that you're as informed as possible. So please take this time, give us a call, 1-800-525-9917, or go online at klw.org and make your gift. You can start as a monthly gift for as little as $5 a month, and there's some thank you gifts you could take advantage of, but do it today. Don't wait. We have only one more day to go, so make it happen today. Call 1-800-525-9917 or go online at klw.org. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Back to Rose Aguilar and Your Call.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about the global economy with Grace Blakely, a staff writer at the Tribune magazine and host of their weekly podcast, A World to Win. Grace is the author of The Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism. And if you have any questions or comments, if you'd like to If you have any questions about how central banks work and how they contribute to massive inequality, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Grace, I'd love to get your thoughts about how European countries, well, and even Canada, responded to the pandemic in terms of, you know, ensuring that people were able to buy the basics. I mean, I know that Europe has its problems for sure, but I keep thinking about this New York Times. Oh, David, I think you need to bring down the, I can hear some people's voices in the background there. Thank you. I keep thinking about this New York Times piece that looked at two opera singers, one in Germany and one in the United States. It was just really fascinating. The opera singer in the United States is actually thinking about changing jobs because he had such a hard time making ends meet with hardly any assistance. The opera singer in Germany, after taxes, still got $3,050 a month. It was a combination of his company and the German government, and then he did not lose any of his health care. He had full benefits. So can you just talk about this? What are your thoughts about the changes that you've seen between the U.S. and other countries?
Yeah, so there's a lot to say in terms of the specifics of policy. And obviously, the big one is socialized healthcare. Now, in the UK, we obviously have a single-payer healthcare system, which is free at the point of use, which is the NHS. In lots of different European countries, they have various different forms of kind of social insurance schemes. But ultimately, you know, a lot of the cost of your treatment for various different illnesses is going to be covered to a greater or lesser extent by the states. The big difference there is with the US that, you know, there is just this fully privatized, apart from some subsidies to the poor and to the elderly, system of healthcare, which, you know, occasionally over here in the UK, you'll see a staggering medical bill for, you know, giving birth or an accident pop up on our timelines. And we just find it utterly shocking. It's almost, you know, it pretty much is across the political spectrum. There is a lot of kind of support for the NHS as an institution. And especially over the course of the pandemic, that support has grown. So I think a lot of people just find it staggering that a country as wealthy as America has not progressed towards something like universal healthcare, which is something that even many poorer countries prioritize in order to ensure that they just have the basics that are required to allow them to develop. If you don't have a healthy workforce, if people are so concerned about getting ill that they are saving loads of money, then that is not going to help your economy. So it is quite shocking that the healthcare industry in the US is so powerful that it is just standing in the way of any real progress on achieving something like Medicare for All. So that is, I think, you know, the big difference in terms of what we've seen in the US and the rest of Europe. That's not to say our healthcare systems are perfect. So the NHS, for example, has been chronically underfunded for many, many years. Things like social care, which provides care for the elderly and also people who maybe can't care for themselves because they have chronic illnesses or disabilities, is not provided through a kind of socialized system. It's through a different kind of set of structures. So that's a problem as well. The public health budget, which would have been really kind of important when this pandemic started, has been cut a lot as well. So things aren't perfect, but the fact of the existence of socialized medicine is obviously a really important. Now, the other factors have to do with the way in which the state has stepped in to kind of backstop incomes and make sure that workers are, you know, basically that you know, there either isn't mass unemployment, or if unemployment does go up, then people are able to care for themselves. So in the UK, for example, along with many other countries in Europe, we had the furlough scheme, which is basically that the government has said, if you keep your workers on, even if they're not coming to work, we will pay anything between 60 and 80% of their wages for you. So effectively, the government has been paying a lot of people's wages to ensure that they aren't laid off, that they can go back to work when things go back to normal, if, you know, normal is ever something that actually returns, which I think is a big question that we have to consider very seriously right now. Whereas in the US, I know that there have been some schemes of that nature, but again, they vary state by state, and a lot of people have been left out of that coverage. Then you have the basic foundation of the level of unemployment insurance in each of these economies. And in the US, by design, unemployment insurance is very ungenerous, because there is this narrative that if you become employed, it's your fault, even though, you know, it's predominantly, levels of unemployment are predominantly due to the state of the economic cycle. When there's a recession, people will be laid off. And often those people will be very, you know, hard workers. Not that should really have an impact on your ability to survive, but still, it just shows that what's really in question here is what's going on in the wider economy. And in, you know, in the UK, we don't have a very generous system of welfare, but it is at least, you know, there. And it's national. And there's been a small uplift to the amount that people can get through unemployment insurance. But that is a really, really big gap for the UK as well. In other parts of Europe, it's much unemployment insurance is much, much better. It's seen as a genuine form of insurance. So something like health insurance, for example, that everyone's going to need at some point in their lives, like a pension or whatever. And so everyone should pay into and everyone should get out of, rather than something that's just for kind of the poor or whoever else. And I think one of the big factors in explaining the different ways that workers have been treated in these different countries, perhaps one of the most important factors, is that question that I had mentioned earlier of power. So in a lot of European countries, not all of them by any stretch of the imagination, but some of them, the labor movement is a much more significant force in politics. So there are large, powerful unions who maybe don't represent adequately all of their members' interests, but certainly play a very significant role in politics and are able to push governments to say, you know, just as big businesses have to say, we need bailouts. These kind of powerful labor movement organizations have been able to say to their governments, you need to be providing, you know, X, Y, and Z for workers. And that has been the case to an extent in the UK as well. In the US, there is this problem of the kind of just, you know, long-term attack that there has been on the labor movement, which has to an extent been the case in the UK as well. But, you know, the kind of toxic nature of this idea of right to work in the US has obviously been very, very problematic. And the labor movement has been beaten back across a lot of different areas. So that's been a really, really big problem, especially when you think about those kind of major low-pay employers. And just the extent that those companies will go to prevent a union from even emerging in the first place. I think that really tells you quite how much is at stake from working people coming together and organizing to demand better pay and better conditions. So that question of power, I think, is really, really important. In America, you know, the society that has been constructed is really a society that is built in the interests of big business and big finance. So when there's a recession, the banks get a bailout, big businesses get a bailout, but working people are largely left to fend for themselves. And, you know, that both feeds into this problem of power, because big businesses that get bailouts are more likely to survive and be able to lobby in the future, whereas working people are going to be massively disempowered by their inability, basically, ever to become unemployed. You know, you can't strike. Really, it's such a risk to strike in the US, because you'll lose your job, you'll lose your healthcare, all these terrible things could happen to you. So it creates this really negative reinforcing cycle of just disempowering ordinary people and making them feel like they can't really change anything. And I think that's probably the biggest problem in the US at the moment. And actually, you know, one thing I will say, I, you know, wasn't a big supporter of Biden. Obviously, you know, he was the less bad option relative to Trump, but some of the stuff in this stimulus package will go some way to alleviating some of those issues, but it's not going to solve that fundamental question of the imbalance of power between working people and big business, because for every penny that the average worker is going to get, the average corporation is going to get a dollar.
Talk about that in a minute, but since you brought up unions, I just wanted to give listeners an update. Truthout is reporting that Amazon hired the country's largest and most expensive union avoidance law firm, Morgan Lewis. Amazon is paying almost $10,000 a day plus expenses to three anti-union consultants. And the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, has a piece out about Amazon fighting aggressively to defeat this drive in Alabama, fearing a major, major wave. So we are going to be doing shows about this in the coming weeks, because people are set to vote in the next couple of weeks. But we do have a question from a listener about the differences between countries and unemployment benefits. So let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Thanks for holding.
Well, just because of your guest's comment about power imbalance, I mean, I remember the smile on McConnell and Mnuchin's faces after they had set their deal, which was going to help Wall Street and not Main Street. But the problem of unemployment in this country, unemployment benefits in this country, has been around a long time. I had a chance to meet the German Minister of Women, Children, and Youth shortly after their reunification, and she was astonished when I told her that unemployment here normally would be up to half of what people were earning, whereas in Germany it's a totally different thing. It's not a stick, you know, that says, oh, you have to take a job that pays you 20% less. They paid like 90 or 95% of the wages for up to a year.
Mm. Well, Bill, thank you so much for the comment. I'm going to take two more callers and then we'll get Grace to respond because people have been holding. Thank you, Bill. Nice to hear from you. I hope you're well. Ural in San Francisco. Hi, Ural. Thank you for holding.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having Blakely on. She sounds very learned. So one thing she said earlier, well, actually, first, unemployment. I'm unemployed, and it is very much my fault. There should be no doubt about that. Secondly, one thing you said earlier about wealth transfer. I'm peripherally in the construction business, and in this city, two projects that come to mind, Central Subway and General Hospital, are massive wealth transfers from public funds to private interests. Projects that no one will ultimately know the total cost of. And as far as Central Subway, it just will never end. It just goes on and on. So that's one sector of the economy where that is very much the case.
Yeah.
Lastly, having some time on my hands, as previously stated, I kind of went through my bookshelves, and I found George Soros's book, and she's an economist. She probably knows him, Alchemy of Finance. And he states some pretty obvious things when you look at it clearly. The regulators and what he calls the competitors, the ratio is completely out of whack. And this is my question. How is it possible, if it is possible, to get the smart people out of education and out of finance and into regulation in this very administration, the Biden administration? Can we get the smart people to work in government as opposed to working in finance?
Well, thank you so much for the call. We're going to take one more, and then we'll get a comment. Let's go to Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede.
Hi, good morning. As I said a couple of weeks ago, really, the U.S. economy is broken and beyond repair. Really, it is. Within the last 40 years, we're arguing about raising minimum wage from, say, $2.50, $3, $5, to $15, that's three times. What happened to housing? Housing is 40 times. A lousy $25,000 house in Berkeley in the 80s. Now is $1 million plus. I just like to say the only solution, a lot of that money was shifted by the neoliberalism, by Friedman and his brothers and the rest of them, and now you have some idiot like the guy from Amazon own about more money than 100 million American. We need to put ceiling on wealth. All of that wealth was shifted by the Wall Street goons, and that the money was really shifted, credit card the scams, loan shark scams, bubble after bubble economy, the Wall Street garbage. We need to put ceiling wealth, say $50 million per person. If that's not done, goodbye, USA. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. Nothing will fix it. Thank you.
Well, thanks for calling, Ede. Grace, we have just about 5 minutes left. Do you want to first respond to Ede?
Yeah, can I just firstly say, wow, what fantastic and well-informed listeners you have, because those were some really great questions. That last question on housing and finance and this need to put a ceiling on wealth, I think is really, really important. I've written quite a lot about the links between the housing market and the finance system. And what we've basically seen is that banks have the capacity to, obviously, as we saw before the financial crisis, create lots and lots of new money and direct it into the housing market. And in doing so, they push up house prices. And in systems where you don't have state provision of housing, that promotes landlordism, increases rents, and makes it very, very difficult for a lot of people to survive, basically. So, you know, this idea of taxing wealth in order to make sure that wealth inequality doesn't become too high is very important. But so are things like rent controls, you know, and also having an adequate system of social housing. There's a reason that the period after the Second World War in both of the US and the UK was a period of high growth, because working class people were able to rely on relatively lower rents, often a level of state or municipal provided housing. They had higher wages. They were represented in unions. And there were very high taxes on wealth at the top end. And what that meant was that money wasn't all being sucked up to the top of the economy, where it just sits in wealthy people's bank accounts. It was recirculating. And, you know, Ed is quite right to say that if that isn't something that's fixed, then we're going to get more and more crises as time goes on.
Well, thank you for the call, Ed. What about the call about regulation? I've been struck by a couple of people that Biden has appointed to his economics team. These are people who are progressive and they care deeply about inequality, whereas a lot of people in the Obama administration had very close ties to Wall Street.
I mean, this, I think, really speaks to the fundamental question here, which is that what happens in government is really a reflection of the balance of power in society as a whole. So when you have a powerful labor movement, you have a powerful movement, a social movement that is pushing for the government to take action on certain issues, you know, that perhaps doesn't equate with the power of organized finance and big business, but it certainly puts a counter to it. And under the Obama years, that movement didn't really exist. It had been beaten back over successive decades. Whereas over the last 10 years, we've seen the reemergence of a movement, of several movements that are saying, we have had enough of high inequality, of all the issues that are associated with that. So Biden's under pressure to show that he is responding to that. And, you know, whether it's from the right or the left, to say that he is actually seeing that pressure and that he's kind of working to make sure he's on the side of the average person. The other thing that caller mentioned, which was, I think, a really important point, was around giveaways to the private sector that take place through infrastructure and construction. This is, you know, this is not a coincidence that this is often stuff that was, you know, there were cuts being given to various kind of organized crime organizations. Infrastructure and construction today is, you know, in many ways very corrupt. There is a lot of public sector money that is siphoned off into private firms who perhaps don't perform as efficiently as they would if there was any constraint on what they were doing. So I want to just kind of reinforce that point that this is another way in which the state is giving money to big business at the same time as saying, oh, we can't afford to support people who are unemployed.
And then you go back to the question of power, and Bill brought up the question of power around the unemployment benefits. Senator Joe Manchin represents West Virginia, a state with just under 2 million people, compared to California, a state with 40 million. But because the Dems have just 50 seats in the Senate, he wielded enough power to bring down additional monthly unemployment benefits from $400 to $300 a week, and successfully fought to remove the 15-hour minimum wage increase from the bill. I just wonder what it looks like from the UK. Do European politicians have this much power? Can one politician do something like this? And we're almost out of time.
Yeah, I mean, just watching that was absolutely horrific. And I mean, it really depends on the political system from place to place, but generally speaking, the US system is uniquely, I think, prone to being co-opted by vested interests, whether that's because of things like, you know, the capacity to filibuster, or because of the kind of, you know, the massive inequalities that exist between the House and the Senate, and the lack of any real proportionality in terms of voting, all these different issues. It's a very, very unproportional system. It's really an undemocratic system. And I think, you know, you see that the more democratic systems are generally the ones in which the majority, the interests of the majority, are better represented. Now, there are ways of making sure that the majority is kind of cut off from accessing political power in all of these democracies. None of them is perfect. But certainly some of them organized working class people are better represented. And as a result of that, they get more in terms of social security, in terms of healthcare, in terms of all these different benefits. So that's really, I think, the big challenge here.
Well, Grace, thank you so much for all of this information. We'd love to have you back to focus on solutions and how to create really a working class movement. So thank you for your work and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Grace Blakely is author of The Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. And I am here with our development director, John Carroll, asking for you to support KALW and Your Call. It is day two of our three-day membership campaign. We are ending this very short drive tomorrow. So now is a great time to support KALW and Your Call, a show that can take an issue and actually spend an entire hour on it.
A fascinating hour.
Well, and then also, John, you can't talk about central banks without having a lot of time.
Right, yeah.
Right? And that, I think that's why it just doesn't get that much attention. So support that kind of radio by calling 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or kalw.org.
Yeah, Rose, I think you're, I mean, that I think is what's most important about the work that we do here at KALW is that, you know, our news programs not only work to bring you the headlines and but also to bring you the information that you need to know around what's happening. What do these things mean? What's the context for this community? The show that you just heard about, Income Equality, building a movement, it's like those are the kinds of things that you don't hear past a two-minute soundbite on a headline story. That's the context that your local public radio station provides, and that's why we're asking you to support it, because 70% of our operating budget comes from listeners just like you. That means people giving us $10 a month, $20 a month, $100 a month, whatever it is. It's your support that makes that happen. So call us at 1-800-525-9917 or go online at kalw.org and make that donation.
800-525-9917, kalw.org. This is a three-day drive. We're right in the middle of it. You might forget tomorrow, so now would be a great time to show your support for KALW and Your Call. And if you start with a new monthly gift, it will be matched. So $10 a month,